So, chapter 8 in the book of Revelation. Yep. Oh, yeah, okay. A little discombobulated today, if you can't tell. Yesterday was a long one. So, here we are. All right, chapter 8. And with chapter 7, last class, what we had was we had kind of an intermission. We stepped back from the image that we received from the first six chapters of Revelation. Specifically, we saw the scroll that was given to the Lamb that was worthy. And who was that? Christ, right? He was the one that was found worthy to loose the seals and to take the scroll. He took it from him that was on the throne, and he was opening the seals, with each seal that was being opened, there was a consequence for the scroll being unraveled or revealed to us. And we got through six of those. And then right before the concluding remark of the seventh seal, there is this side picture that we saw where John zooms out from that scroll scene and we get the 144,000 saved of each tribe of Israel and then the innumerable multitude that was there along with the elders, along with those that overcame, and along with the angelic beings that were present at the throne room. And they all had a picture of worship. And that was the concluding remark on chapter 7, was that great picture of the heavenly throne room where everyone that was redeemed is there worshiping the Father, which of course gives us a very clear picture in a spiritual way of what heaven is going to be. So when it comes to the throne room, when it comes to the Lamb, when it comes through heaven, we've seen three times now that when John zooms out, absolutely everything rejoices and worships and has adoration to the Father, to the Lamb, and to the Spirit. So that's kind of the main picture we've seen so far. And then when we back out and see that picture, then we zoom in again to get more of the imagery of what was taking place. So in chapter 8, what we do is we kind of zoom in once again to that image of the scroll being loosed, and we get the final seal being loosed by Christ. And that preludes us into going to the seven trumpets. So we had the seven churches, right? The seven seals, and now the seven trumpets will begin. So there's a pattern here developing, obviously. We covered that in the introduction. There's this picture of seven being completely seen throughout the book of Revelation. And before we get into the actual text, do we have any questions or comments or confusions thus far? All right, if you're confused now, just wait. There's more to come. That was really, again, the easy section. That's not that difficult to kind of interpret the scroll or the message, the content that only Jesus was authorized to unveil to the world was the good news of his resurrection, the gospel plan of salvation. And with each loosening of that seal, of that message of the gospel, there is a physical consequence upon the earth. And the last one that we saw was a picture of nature itself being turned upside down. There being earthquakes and thunderings and lightnings, and the sun doesn't shine, the stars fall from heaven. It's a picture of just the world being just turned upside down by the gospel. That's what that picture is. So here for the seven trumpets, there's going to be a reaction based on those seven seals. So we'll cover that in just a few moments. All right, verse 1. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Now, how many ideas of heaven are there in the Jewish world? Anyone remember?
Seven.
Not seven. That's a good number, though. How many heavens are there in the Jewish world?
Three.
Four. Who said three? Four. There are four of them, all right? We talked about this before. Whenever you see the word heaven, especially when it comes to the Old Testament, you have to assume that we're talking about one of the four. So the context determines which of the four we're actually talking about. So you have the first heaven, which is what? It's where the birds are. When you go outside and you see the birds flying through the heavens, is that literally heaven? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. In the literal sense, it's a heaven, but just in the first realm of the Jewish world. When you go to the book of Psalms, And you read about the heavens, and there's a remark about how wonderful nature is and all the birds that fly through the heavens. That's the first realm of heaven, where our head is another expression that we talk about when meaning the heavens. The second one is outer space, right? You got planets, you got stars, you have heavenly hosts, which is a figure of speech for the stars. And you have that heavenly host talking about outer space, right? We look up, see the stars, see the heavens. That's right above, from our perspective, that first realm of heaven. The third realm of heaven is the one that we're probably familiar with the most. It's the idea of being in a place of reward after death. That's kind of an important one, right? We all talk about heaven that kind of way. It's more of a general archetype than it is a specific location. And then the fourth one is a bit more complex, but it's still quite easy. It's the idea of being where God is. So if you're with God in God's realm, in the spiritual realm, then you're in the fourth heaven. So when Paul talked about him knowing someone that was caught up in the fourth heaven, guess where he was? In the spiritual realm. He died, right? He was in the afterlife before he was allowed to come back when he was stoned outside Lystra. So that's the four heavens we talk about. So when you see that... It says third, right? Seventh heaven's a whole different thing, all right? It's a TV show I used to watch, an ABC Family, back when they had family programming on there. Anyway, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Now, given the context here, in verse 2, I saw the seven angels who stand before God. We're not talking about the heaven in this context, because, of course, John was a Jew before, so he would write in this kind of way. Not talking about where the birds are, where the stars are, or really even where the place of reward is. We're talking about where God is, the throne room. So there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. All right, so as we read this, we know what's coming. He sees seven angels, they have seven trumpets. Where's the word seven, or the number seven, represent to us? Complete, perfection, full-grown, matureness, all this idea of the word teleos in the Greek. It's the idea of it being complete, right? So here, he sees the seven trumpets given to the seven angels who stand before God. As far as I can remember, we haven't been introduced to these seven angels specifically. We found the four that was there when Isaiah saw them, and then when John saw them, right? We saw the seven spirits of God, the seven messengers of God, the angels being present there. But these seven angels at this particular location are now segueing us into a new text. Then another angel, having a golden censer. What is a censer? Not someone that bleeps you out when you curse too much, right? What's a censer? Okay, it was, we kind of see it in the Catholic Church today in some way. It's a bit different than it was in the Old Testament, but you'll have this essentially a ball on a rope or on a chain, and within there you have a flame instrument, and then you place incense inside the censer, and you move it around, and they swing it back and forth to get the air moving through there, and then that will create the smoke from the incense to go and fill the area. So it's a bit different in the Old Testament. It was stationary, where you would burn this incense. So having a golden censer, a location or a thing to burn the incense, came and stood at the altar. Now, we've seen the altar before, haven't we? We've seen the throne room and the altar. What is an altar? Not really a seat, unless your definition of seat also includes being killed on it. If that's definition, then yeah, it's definitely a seat. It's a location where you would make a sacrifice, right? An altar in our world, especially in the Eastern cultures, is a little bit different. Now, you don't necessarily kill something on it. It's just a place of worship or adoration. An altar in the Old Testament was where you went to kill the animals, right? So the altar was kind of the focal point of the place that you would offer the sacrifice. Now, we saw earlier that there were saints under the altar, implying, of course, that they lost their life for the sake of Christ. And they were killed because of Christianity. So he came, he stood at the altar. He was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. We've already had revealed to us that the incense and the smoke was a typification of the prayers of the saints. So they're going to be offering these prayers, this incense, before the throne room of God. All right, same picture we saw before. Verse 4. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. So we have this picture of the angel having the thing to offer incense, which is a typification of the prayers of the saints. He comes before the altar of God, offers the prayers of the saints in this kind of symbolic way, takes the incense, takes the smoke, and throws it to the earth. What could that represent, you think? The prayers of the saints being sent back to the earth. And the room grew quiet. Okay. All right, that's probably good, considering what we find right after this. The idea of the prayers being before God no doubt would have been comforting to know that there is an angel dedicated to offering the prayers that they've been offering up in their tribulation to comfort them. It being sent back down to earth shows us that there is something coming upon the earth that their prayers cannot even hinder, is what my understanding of what this may be. Their prayers are not going to affect the outcome of the events that are about to happen with the rest of these trumpets being sounded. Not to discourage people from praying, obviously, but to just warn them that what's about to take place is already kind of set, is my understanding of what we find here. All right, verse 6. Verse 5, part B. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. And we already made the application or the discussion about what the significance of a trumpet is. When someone sneaks up behind you with a trumpet and blows it behind you and you're not ready for it, what's your reaction? Punch him right in the face, right? Immediate knee-jerk reaction, just knock that guy out cold. But no. You're surprised. You're shocked. It comes without warning. So when you have these seven trumpets sounding, the entire earth is going to be surprised, shocked, alarmed by the events that will take place. That's the significance behind the trumpets. So in verse 7, we find the first trumpet being revealed for us. Now, there are two different ways, as far as I know, that you can look at these trumpets sounding and the results of what takes place. Either we're talking about a literal event that happened either in the first, second, or third century, in which these things actually took place under the Roman rule, and the world was affected by it. It's more of a literal interpretation. Now, the second way is these things are all symbolic, as they have always been. And when you're talking about the crops of the earth, you don't really mean the crops of the earth. When you talk about locusts coming up from the pit of hell, you don't really mean locusts from the pit of hell. It means something else. And to me, that makes the most sense. The third way to look at this, which is incorrect, is that this is going to take place in our future. So when there is a great plague that happens against our vegetation, this is a symbol that we've been warned about because we have to prepare ourselves for Judgment Day. That's incorrect because we're not to be prepared for Judgment Day because of these signs. We're to always be ready. So there's not going to be a sign given to us when Christ is going to come back. So looking at these trumpets sounding, I'm going to be looking at them from the perspective of it's all still symbolic. It's not literal here, and I can't say it is because nothing has been literal here. It's all been figurative in the sense of trying to show us symbols of what these things are. So that's my perspective from this. You don't have to agree with that. That's by no means a matter of salvation here, in my opinion. And so we just move through the symbols here and figure out what they could mean for us, and we move on. All right, verse 7. The first angel sounded. So the trumpet sound went off. There was a shock. There was news coming to the world. And hail and fire followed, mingled with blood. and they were thrown to the earth. So there was this act of nature that was mingled with blood. Again, we don't have any historical records of this literally happening in the Roman world. We don't know of any time that we can point at in history that says, you know, blood came from the sky. What we can do is say this blood is symbolic of the martyr's blood that was being shed, and it was falling from the sky because it was absolutely everywhere. So the idea of hail and fire being destructive, when you had hail talked about in the Old Testament, it destroyed crops, it destroyed livelihoods and even lives because of starvation. So the symbol here seems to follow that there was destruction and fire and death raining from the sky, it would seem, mingle with blood, possibly of the martyrs that were losing their lives. And a third of the trees were burnt up. All right, again, this is not a historical situation. We don't have anyone like Josephus that records, and by the way, we lost a third of all the trees around the entire earth. It's just a figure of speech to show us that that which we rely on, that we think is secure, that will always be there for us, the forestry industry, it's no longer as reliable as it was. And all the green grass was burned up. So the idea of vegetation being struck here, the entire earth being affected by the blood of destruction by the martyrs, is kind of the image. The second trumpet. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood. Now, if you remember, I gave you a chart when we first started this class of a table of symbols, and it was very, very basic. But it was based on the idea that when you look into the Old Testament prophets, major and minor, they spoke in apocalyptic literature. They spoke in such a way that it was veiled to the common reader. And they would use symbols to mean something else when they wanted to say something very specific. What does the idea of the sea mean in the Old Testament? Anyone remember or have that chart right in front of them? When you're talking about a large mass of people at one location, and you look out and you see all their heads bobbing as they're moving together, and maybe in a race or in a charity walk or at an amusement park, you just see a sea of people before you. That's the imagery that we find here in the Old Testament. As when you're talking about the sea, you don't normally literally mean the salty oceans around the world. You mean the sea of people. So we find the vegetation, that which gives life, that which is industrious to the world, being affected by the blood of the martyrs in the first trumpet. The second trumpet, a third of the population seems to be affected by this great tribulation. Now that would have been significant because if there was a great campaign by a Roman emperor specifically to try and kill and squash out Christianity for being the scapegoat for all his problems and struggles in the empire, if you kill all the Christians, you're going to lose a lot of people in your empire, are you not? So the second trumpet here to me symbolizes the idea of the Christian world being persecuted, especially by Rome at this point in time and in the future from the writing of this book. And you're going to find that the people are affected because of this great tribulation. So again, something kind of like a great mountain on fire being thrown into the sea or into the people, and a third of the sea became blood. So you find nothing but bloodshed being a result of this great disastrous work. And a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. So again, this picture of destruction and death with blood is completely seen here in these two trumpets. Okay, any questions or comments so far? All right, hang with me. It gets even a bit more crazy as we go on, all right? Verse 10. Then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven. What do stars usually represent in the Old Testament, especially those that fall to earth? That was a great whisper. Can I hear it? Angels? Okay, sometimes. The devil? Okay, possibly. Usually when you talk about great stars falling from heaven, it's specifically in a reference to some great king, some great emperor, some great ruler, and being thrown down to earth or being cast down to earth is a symbolic picture of them losing that power and prestige. Hezekiah, that was talked about when he lost his throne, lost his estate, lost his power. He was a great star that fell from heaven. Now, there were kings of old empires talked about in the book of Ezekiel. From that king being cast down to earth, it seems to typify possibly what happened to Satan. We kind of have to conjecture about that because it's not obvious that's what God meant, but it seems to be the case. So when we find that the population is struck with blood, destruction, and even the sea of people to a third of its population is being just full of the blood of martyrs. And then the waters being struck here in verse 10, a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, meaning that he was, of course, burning with power is the imagery here. It fell on the third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is wormwood, which was a type of kind of poison almost. It would make the waters bitter, this root. And a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. So you have some folks that look at this and say, you know what, this is literal, because in the second century there was a great drought, and this water was dried up, and people must have died because of it. This is that prophecy. Could be, or it could be just a symbol that which brings forth life, or at least should, a spring of running water or living water, instead of bringing forth life, brought forth death. That's the symbolic picture here. The one that should have brought life brought death. And with that great image of the star burning brightly, falling to earth, to me, it seems to probably indicate to us a specific ruler, no doubt an emperor of Rome, that should have brought life to his empire is now bringing forth death, and everything that he affects is going to die because of it. That seems to be the typification that I find here most often. And that did happen under Domitian, so that definitely fits our timeline of which emperor is going to be in charge and what's going to happen when he takes place. He could have stopped persecution, but he didn't. He increased it. All right, verse 12. And the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun was struck. So, again, this is more evidence to me that we're not talking about a literal event. They didn't look up one day, and a third of the sun is just gone. It's never come back. A third of the moon, a third of the stars, so that a third of them were darkened. A third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. And I looked, and I heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." What does that indicate to us? If you are depressed about what's going on currently, hang in there. It's going to get worse. Now, that would have been important to hear, because if John is, in fact, writing to the Christians of the first, second, and third century after the establishment of the church, and discussing here in a symbolic way the great persecution that's going to arise under the Roman Empire and the Jewish world combining, things get so bad, it seems like the stars aren't there anymore. The sun's not there anymore. The moon's not there anymore. The ocean's not there anymore. There's no trees. There's no green grass. You get a picture of bleakness, of destruction, of death. So to be told about this taking place in a spiritual way is significant to keep the people that are trying to remain strong going on the right path, because now they have somewhat of a blueprint of what this persecution is going to look like. That seems to be the best way that I've seen this book talked about is to encourage Christians to continue moving forward because they know what's going to happen. It's going to get a whole lot worse before it gets better. Okay, chapter 9, verse 1. Now, in this chapter, we're going to be introduced to a pest. And this pest is described in such a way that it's reminiscent of what took place in the book of Exodus, but just kind of on steroids. So we'll see that kind of picked up here in a couple of verses. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth. So someone of great authority that was shining bright in the stars is now thrown down to the earth, meaning that he has lost his power. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit. Now, immediately here, our mind thinks about Hades, thinks about hell. The bottomless pit here is not described that way quite yet, but the symbology here is simply it being like a burning furnace. So, of course, our mind goes there immediately. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. I've been grilling before, and you have the grill going, and you got your steak on there, you got your corn on the cob on there, you got your chicken on there, you got your hot dogs on there. Everything's going really well. You can tell it's burning up really, really nice. And then you open the grill. What happens? Poof! Smoke goes up, blocks out the sky for a split second. One time, had this little cheap rusty grill that I was cooking out for the church to have like a fellowship meal, and I had an entire bag from Costco of charcoal burning in the bottom of this grill, right? Put the whole bag in there, just lit on fire. Perfect way to start a grill. Everything was going really good, kind of greasy hamburgers on there, right? The frozen ones you throw on there and make so much grease the whole thing is on fire. So everything's closed, everything's good. And then I opened it. Guess what happened? The smoke went up, and the smoke caught on fire. Whole thing went, my whole arm, all my hair was gone off my arm. So the imagery here, we can understand. Verse 2, when he opened that pit, there was so much heat. It had been closed for so long, but the burning was still there. The smoke went up and blocked out the sun. Verse 3. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. Think about a locust, right? What's a locust? Big grasshopper. That's how you say it, right? I always thought it was the cicada. I always thought for a while that a cicada was a locust. So when I saw a cicada, I was like, look at that locust over there. There's the locust shell on the tree. Like, no, it's a cicada. It's a little bit different. They're more annoying with the sound they make if they're right in your ear, right? But the large grasshoppers that are being talked about here, they're so powerful that they're as powerful as a scorpion. Now, I've not lived in a climate where scorpions are common. Do we have scorpions here?
Yeah.
Do we? Not many? Okay, well, that's good to hear. At least we have gators, apparently. I got an email from our apartment complex, and they said, just so you know, the pond over here has got a gator in it. Don't feed it. I'm like, who's going to feed a gator in the backyard? Got cats and dogs running around. Anyway, so what are they talking about? Scorpions. We don't live in a climate where we have a lot of scorpions, in my estimation anyway. I've never actually seen one in real life besides like in a zoo and like in a little thing. And I know what I'm not going to do is just walk over and pick the guy up. Like, I've never been stung by it. May not kill me. It's not going to feel good, is it? It's going to hurt. It might kill me. I don't know. I've never been stung by one. We'll find out one day, I guess. So that's the idea here is you see something like a grasshopper, like a locust, and they're destructive in and of themselves. Their very nature is to destroy and to consume the food that we would normally eat. So that's bad enough. But then when you have locusts that have the power and the stinging ability of a scorpion, they're flying around, no thanks. I'm okay, right? This is bad enough, it makes it even worse. Verse 4, they were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth, nor any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Uh-oh. So these locusts aren't literal, right? It's a symbol. In just a few moments, we'll see what their armor looks like. And there are only a few things I can think of in the Roman world that are decked out in armor that are destructive by their very nature when they come in swarms, but they have the stinging power of death like a scorpion. We're talking about the Roman military might here. So those who do not have the seal of God on their forehead. We talked about that before in previous chapters. What does this symbolize for us? The seal of God on their foreheads. Protection because of the seal. Is it literal? Is there a brand mark on the seal, on the forehead of these people? Right, so we have bind the law upon your hands and upon your forehead in the Old Testament law. They took that literally. They bound with a little box these phylacteries on their body parts because God said so. The intent was when you bind it on your hands, whatever you do is governed by the Word of God. When you have it on your forehead, whatever you think is by the Word of God. So what you do and what you think are all contained by the Word of God, the law of God, on their hearts and on their mind. So the seal of God, the ownership of God, the authority of God, being on someone's forehead indicates to us that they have God in their mind, on their mind. So they were to harm those who did not have that seal at this particular point in time, verse 4, verse 5. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Now, what's 5 months indicate to us? Probably in this context, a short period of time in reference to a longer period of time. If you know that you're going to be jobless, let's say, for 5 months, that's better than being jobless for a year, right? It's still bad, but it's better than for a longer period of time. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. What's that like? Anybody know for sure? No one knows? You know? Is it pretty bad?
It hurts.
It hurts. All right. Good enough for me. Verse 6. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. Now, there are only a few occasions that I know about where a prophet writes about a time where men want to die but can't. And that time only comes through conquest and campaign of a great military empire. When you have Babylon, you have the Medo-Persian Empire, in Assyria especially, when they came to take away or to at least afflict Israel, there were times talked about where men would seek death and it would not come to them because they were getting the reward of, or the consequence rather, of their actions. They will desire to die and death will flee from them. The shape of the locust was like horses prepared for battle. Interesting connection. What are we talking about here, folks? Right? You get the imagery. On their heads were crowns of something like gold. So again, this is all a picture John's trying to paint for us, given what he's been seeing here in this great event. And on their faces were like the faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and teeth were like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. The swarming nature of the Roman military might, the way that it sounded in battle, sounded like these locusts swarming down upon crops and devouring it, was the imagery here. They had tails like scorpions. They were and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months, so a limited, specified, short, relatively, point of time. And they had as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. Those two words in Hebrew and Greek both mean destroyer. So they had a king or a leader over them who was the destroyer, who was the one who was authorized to open this great military conquest in the first place. One woe is past, Behold, still two more woes are coming after these things. All right, so what have we seen? Big picture here to kind of pan out for a moment. Jesus is the Lamb. He was worthy through his life, through his sacrifice, to receive the scroll, the hidden message from God. And he was authorized to open the seven seals to reveal the message of God. With each opening of the seal, something happened on the earth that was a consequence of the gospel being revealed. The last one was the entire world was turned upside down, was the sixth seal, technically. We then pan out, we see an image of heaven once again. Those who were redeemed, those who remained faithful, were in an eternal state of happiness and bliss and worship because they made it through the destruction of this world. Speaking of which, we zoom in once again and we find the seven trumpets now being there. With the trumpets that are a shock to the earth, there's great persecution, there's bloodshed, there's destruction. Specifically, we see in that symbology possibly that the entire population of Christians in the Roman world are now trying to be squashed out. Never happened, never will, but that's the attempt. And now we're seeing these great woes coming upon the world through someone in a great Roman military leadership capacity opening the floodgates for a time of persecution from the Roman military, right? We've seen that so far. So now we continue the imagery and we find this in verse 13. Then the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God. Now, the altar of God had four horns on it, and they weren't like literal horns that were attached. They were kind of end pieces, end caps that went up and kind of made the altar almost kind of like a basin. So horns of the altar usually symbolize the power of sacrifice. So horns are usually power. You have horns of great nations and Daniel, for example, and great kings. You have the horns of the altar. The power of sacrifice is the idea behind that. So a voice from the power of sacrifice, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. Where is the Euphrates River, basically? Not Europe. Close, though. Middle East, not Egypt. It's kind of like towards Iraq, Iran area, right? It goes all the way throughout there where we think the Garden of Eden was, somewhere in the middle of that location between those rivers. So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and the day and the month and the year, were they prepared for this very specific time frame? Yes, that's the meaning. They were released to kill a third of mankind. Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million, and I heard the number of them. So it seems to indicate he just overheard how many there were. 200 million is not a small number, is it? Not in my mind. And thus I saw the horses and the vision, the locusts, right? Those who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, hyacinth blue, and sulfur yellow, and the heads of the horses were like the heads of lions, and out of the mouths came fire, smoke, and brimstone. By these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed by the fire and by the smoke and the brimstone which came out of their mouths. For their power was in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents having heads, and with them they do harm. But the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons, the idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. They did not repent of their murders, of their sorceries, or of their fornications, or of their thefts. One side note, that word sexual immorality we find there in the New King James, ESV, NASB, NIV, all the newer translations, it's the word porneia. That word porneia, we get pornography from, the idea of fornication. So when I read fornication, that's just me inserting the proper word for it instead of sexual immorality, just kind of heads up. So what do we see here? Well, we see that we had a great Roman, probably, military power taking charge because of this great rule and hurting those that did not have the seal of God on their forehead for a short period of time, 5 months. And then we see another force that was over by the Euphrates coming and warring against them. There was a great battle, there was great destruction, and there was, of course, military conquest and fighting going on. So, why would that be significant? Because with all of that military power, all of that campaigning, all of that conquest, all that death, the people were not being woken up to serve the living God. They were still worshiping idols, mentioned here in verse 20. Usually, when you have a great military campaign, you have people looking to God for salvation. They weren't looking to God this time. They were looking to their own idol, specifically the idol of the emperor that they would sacrifice to try and get his allegiance and his help in a time of need. So that was their deity, that was their God at this point in time. And we'll go on to chapter 10, Lord willing, next week and continue. There is an image here about John eating a little book. And it seems a bit strange, but he is referencing another prophet, the same exact thing, and invoking his imagery in this next chapter. So, thank you for your attention, and we'll be dismissed now for about 15 minutes.